Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and the Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful, beautiful black and white, chrome, C41 color neg, and of course, the Instax. They make pack film, and then of course, they have the wide format Instax, and brand new to the country is the Instax Mini. Really cool stuff. Definitely check them out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film for a great hybrid workflow. They'll develop it. They'll do a high-res scan with either a Fuji scanner or a Noritsu. They'll give you proofs. They'll send you back high-res scans. Great way, great workflow. Lots and lots of professional event photographers, wedding photographers are using Richard Photo Lab. People are doing fine art with them. A lot of great stuff going on at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5, the place to send all of your black and white film to turn it into chrome. The most unbelievable process, has the most dynamic range and latitude you've ever seen anywhere. It's just beautiful stuff. Check them out, www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios, Lenny Iger. Matter of fact, Lenny's going to be joining us today later on here, and he's got an Aztec Premiere Pro. You can get 8,000 PPI scans. Unbelievable stuff. Check them out, IgerStudios.com. And of course, Upstrap, upstrap-pro.com for a camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Definitely check them out. Great, great camera strap. And our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog photography, over at www.apug.org. Great organization. You can sign up. You can get your own gallery. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. It's a really great program at APUG. Definitely check them out. Our photographic philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film. Great work going on with the George Eastman House trying to archive the history of photography. You really need to go check this place out if you ever get near Rochester, New York. They have a lot of great stuff online. You can join. They have memberships if you don't live in town. A lot of great benefits. But, you know, the big picture is to keep the history of photography alive. Check them out, www.eastmanhouse.org. We got a great show today. We're going to have with us Lenny Iger. Lenny is a professional photographer, been doing this for many, many, many years. He's the owner of Iger Studios. Very great work going on with Lenny. And we're going to talk today about his photography, how he got into it, his background. He used to do print stuff with Avedon. A lot of cool stuff going on here. Lenny, how you doing today?
It's going great. Enjoying being here with you.
We're here at your studios. Of course, we're at Iger Studios here in beautiful Northern California. Lenny, tell us about yourself. I know that you're very well known for your super crazy high resolution scans, your beautiful print work, but you've been in photography for 40 years. So let's talk about how Lenny got involved in photography. Where'd you get the bug?
Where'd I get the bug? Let's see. My father was a photographer. When I was 7 years old, my dad, who had been working for Life magazine and Vogue and Town and Country, 100 album covers for CBS Music, guys like Benny Goodman, all that in the 50s, got tired of the rat race and took his family to Puerto Rico on the strength of one job for Bacardi Rum. So I grew up there and worked in his darkroom. I helped him out. He did all kinds of wild and crazy stuff. It was the first time I saw somebody develop, what was it? It was either slide film as a negative or negative film as a slide. No, it was slide film as a negative because he didn't want the red mask. He wanted to see how wild and crazy the colors could get. So that was a lot of fun. And it's considered that I took my first photograph when I was 9 or 10 years old. When I was just a kid and I saw some people across the street staring off into a very wild sort of sunset cloud scene, and I ran and grabbed him and dragged him out there with his camera. I had a lot of fun doing that. Like many people, I did my high school yearbook and then bopped around for a while, sort of not really very well directed in my way. I ultimately decided I needed to go back to college and went back to Pratt and got an education. And that was fabulous. That was a really terrific education. There were a lot of great things about Pratt.
Tell me about Pratt. What did you take? What was your major?
I was a photography major from the start, and I came in there thinking I knew something. And the lambasting I got in my first class came down to don't ever bring anything that lousy in this class again kind of attitude from one of the teachers. And then I figured I actually had something to learn. That was a real shock. And as I started to learn, at that time, there were 16 teachers at Pratt in photography. In the photography department, they had a brand new building with, I don't know, 50 or 100 little dark rooms back there. Phil Perkis was the head of the department, and Phil is one of the great unsung heroes in American photography. He's fabulous. And he had collected around him a lot of very, very strong photographers. 15 out of 16 of those teachers were absolutely fantastic. And they were as different as day and night in their approach. And so my mentor ultimately became Phil Perkis, and the guy taught me a tremendous amount.
So when you went to Pratt, did you have any conception in your head of what kind of photography you wanted to do? Was it like, okay, I want to go to New York and shoot fashion. I want to do glamour. I wanted to go shoot broken down buildings in the Southwest. What was your concept when you were going to Pratt, taking photography, but what were you into?
At the time, I didn't really know what the hell I was doing, but I was more into sort of the natural world. That was always my interest. Having grown up in Puerto Rico, I was very connected to everything in nature. It's a very small island, so you can't get away from nature, as it were. So rather than being an urban being like some others, I was much more interested in the natural world and all its wonders. I went to Pratt partially because it was an art school. The one unfortunate thing, which I know they've fixed by now, was at the time, I actually went through 5 or 6 years worth of school there, and I don't think the word money was ever mentioned. It was art for art's sake, pure and simple. Phil was a very deep guy. I think he was a student of Gurdjieff. I don't know if he still is. But he's the kind of guy that could look at a critique of yours and tell you how you were feeling when you photographed. He was incredibly insightful.
So tell me, you graduated from Pratt. What happened next?
Well, I wanted to teach, and I graduated from Pratt with a bachelor's. And ultimately, during that process, I'd gotten involved in larger cameras, and ultimately the 8x10, and then platinum printing. I did a lot of research in platinum. I was one of those people who figured out how many grams of ferric oxalate you could actually get into solution by trying it over and over and over again, and got to a certain level with it. Ultimately, I looked around at some other schools to go to school with to get a master's because I wanted to teach, and ended up back at Pratt with a master's degree. When I graduated from there, I went to Cooper Union. Well, I actually got my foot in the door by being a darkroom technician. I had a little device, a bar with a level on it that could level an enlarger. I'm pretty handy with my hands, and I had those enlargers all squared up and perfect and everything. And sure enough, after being there for a little while, some teacher had to leave. I don't know whether it was some indiscretion or whether he got sick or something happened. And they said, hey, can you take over this class? And then I would get a number of classes to teach. I didn't like being a Cooper. It was a great school, but there were some really difficult things happening there at the time. So I basically decided to leave and went over to Parsons and did the same thing. I got to be the darkroom technician. And sure enough, less than a year later, somebody left for some reason or another. And I was asked, do you know how to teach? And I said, absolutely. And I took over the class. And then the response was so good at the end of the semester that they gave me 4 classes to teach. And so I was there until I left New York in 84.
Tell me about the platinum printing. This was going on the same time you were teaching. You started this more professionally after you left 84. Tell me how that worked in there.
Well, actually, it was around, I don't know, 80 or 82 that I started a business called Platinum Editions in New York. And we did work for a lot of different photographers. John Gruen, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him since. But I did work for Sheila Metzner, Carl Fisher, Dennis Peel, Cosimo, and ultimately did a few pieces for Richard Avedon. And that was a lot of fun. That was terrific working with him. So platinum is a beautiful process. All the alternative printing methods have their areas where they're just exceptional. If you look at a Richard Benson gravure print, it's just a thing of beauty. I mean, I've got a piece from an old gravure from Camera Work here hanging on my wall. And I love all the old processes. And platinum, with its atmosphere, I can speak only for myself, but once I saw a really exquisite platinum print come out of my darkroom, I never wanted to go back to silver again. I love that matte surface. I love all the atmosphere. I love the lack of an emulsion-based surface. It's a super matte surface that allows you to fall into the print, as it were.
And I think you're right. I think that's about the surface and the texture of it and the reflectiveness of the platinum is so much different than even F-surface or any kind of traditional silver paper. With the texture of the paper, depending on what you're using and the way it looks, it does invite you in.
And I don't mean that to take away. I mean, silver paper definitely has its beauty. And looking at a George Tice print with one highlight after another folding over each other, they can be truly exquisite. So it's just a little different. But the lack of reflectivity means that that whole business, it's what I call breaking the ground, where when somebody looks at it, they actually fall in and become part of the image. And they imagine themselves actually in the scene, and they're experiencing it rather than looking at something.
Well, no, I mean, you can tell, and people have to look at the stuff, but I mean, sitting here in your studio, I can look at prints. I see some F paper and I see some platinum and some other of your current work. And the very, very true matte finished stuff makes you look like you're going to just fall in.
Well, I mean, I'm a platinum printer at heart, and I got into inkjet, and now the inkjet, I've gotten it to look like a platinum print. Not exactly like a platinum print. It's got a little bit of a longer tonal range. And what I do is try and blend some of the best parts of silver, like great highlights, and the best parts of platinum, like great shadows, into a particular print. And that's really what it's all about for me, because ultimately, I think art, whether it's photography or another art, should actually teach the viewer something. And what, that's up to them. But I'm interested in a much more experiential feel. I want them to actually experience the work. I mean, we all know what a tree looks like. We all know what a rock looks like or a waterfall. Almost all of us have been to one of these things and have been to a national park and seen beautiful scenes of one form or another. But it's different when you can actually take somebody there, and not necessarily even there. I've got one print, it's called Snow and Pond, that is uncanny in the sense that people find themselves really walking around in the image as they stand in front of it. I've made it very large. It's 32 by 40. And almost everybody that stands in front of it and looks at it has an experience. And whether it's the same experience that I had when I got there, or it's something else that's a memory in their own childhood, it doesn't matter to me. I don't need to give them the exact experience of looking at that particular scene. But I want something to happen. I want something different to happen, rather than just looking at one more pretty picture.
So let's fast forward from 82, 84, from leaving New York. You're on the West Coast. You have Iger Studios. You're doing this exquisite inkjet-based printing. We'll talk about that. I want to talk about your scanning that you're very well known for. You have some really high-end equipment and have been able to master it quite well. Let's talk about what's going on with Lenny these days. You have the studio here. What are you up to?
Working 7 days a week. I guess back in 85, I took a little bit of a break from doing everything and tried to make a living a little bit. And I got some way down the road on that. But photography, as much as it's a great art, it's also a disease, I think. It's something that once you touch something at the core of something and have some of the opportunities that I've had to meet people that really know what photography is all about at its deepest place, it has you in its grip. So now it started with moving into this house. And what happened was that I thought to myself, I'm not going to set up one more darkroom that I'm not going to use. I'm not going to mix up a batch of chemistry and then use it twice and have it sit for 6 months. So I started to look at digital instead of sort of putting all of the plumbing in the garage like I usually did or in a bathroom or whatever. And what happened was I got started with a small digital camera and a little 7500 printer. I got some decent results. One always tests things with an 8x10 print. That's a very natural thing to do. Actually, my first printer was the very slow 2000P, a wait forever printer. I got some okay results, but it was lacking. It was clearly lacking. And at the same time, I also wanted to, obviously, since I've been working for all these years, bring my portfolio into the present and be able to try out what one of my 8x10 negs looked like. Well, I went over to a place that did high-end scanning, and I got it scanned, and I came back, and I went, that's actually what I've been looking for. And so the scan cost me, I don't know, a couple of $100s, and it wasn't even full resolution. Full resolution would have been $300, and I thought, gee, I had maybe 50 negs I wanted to bring forward. So I thought, well, even at $200 a pop, that's $10,000. For $5,000, I can buy a drum scanner. And so I did, and the results were stunning. Even though I had picked up a 16-megapixel Kodak DCS Proback on a Mamiya 645, the scans that I was getting off of my large format on the drum scanner were just miles ahead and actually had the capacity to do everything that I had always done prior in platinum. And so I knew it was going to be a bit of a journey, but I decided to take the plunge and got myself a Haltech 4500. Made a lot of great scans. And after a few years with that, I decided to get more serious and actually pay for some of this with offering some services. So I purchased an Aztec Premier, the big brother of the Haltech 4500, which does 8,000 DPI. It's just an absolutely amazing scanner. It's one of the finest scanners ever made, and it's fast and easy to work with, and the results are terrific. It also allows me to offer scanning services for smaller negs. The Haltech 4500 would have been fine with 4.5s and 8.10s. The Premier offers a little bit more, but not a lot more. But for 35, the Premiere is huge. It's a big difference. So I get 96 megapixels of information off of a 35 millimeter image. So it's pretty good.
So let's talk about that before we finish the rest of the stuff, what you're up to with the studio here. And you probably find this mostly with your clients is everybody loves to capture via analog process, typically film. But a lot of people anymore, I don't think, have the room or the know-how to do traditional printing in a darkroom, color and or black and white. So I think lately we found that this resurgence in analog capture and actually true photographic process, true photography, not digital, but bringing that work into the digital realm. And you currently still shoot lots of 4x5 and 8x10 black and white. So you still shoot analog. And what have you heard from your customers about what they're doing? And I guess you probably find that most people like to still capture the analog.
Well, I would say right off the bat, there's a huge difference between commercial work and fine art. With commercial work, if one is shooting for an 8.5x11 magazine cover, for example, almost any digital camera will work. You really don't need many pixels to get good resolution, lots of tone, lots of dynamic range with all the new tools and everything. So if I was a commercial photographer, I would go digital in almost every case. In some cases, like some architectural, maybe not. But if I was shooting weddings, I think I would probably be primarily digital. When it comes to fine art, what I've noticed is that in my own artwork, people actually notice the quality of the image first, and then they notice the aesthetic. Now, I'm sure this is not true for everybody, but it's true for me. In one sense, we've been bamboozled by marketing. I don't know anybody that knows how much $1 million is and how long it would take to spend. These are big numbers. And when somebody comes across to me and says, "You've got 16 million pixels," I can hear Carl Sagan in the background going, "Billions and billions of galaxies and all this kind of stuff." And we imagine that it's a lot. But the truth is that this is an arithmetic game. When it all is said and done, the 16 megapixel camera was a 4,000 by 4,000 chip. That means instead of multiplying the two sides to create an area calculation, you just say, okay, what have I got on one edge? And if you have 4,000 pixels on an edge and you're making a 20-inch print, then you have 200 dots per inch for each one of those inches. Now, most of us know, and probably all your listeners know, that most of these digital printers like 360 DPI as a minimum. For black and white, get even a little bit more than that. Not that everybody can see it, but those people that are sensitive enough to really go for it can see probably all the way up to 720, but one is splitting hairs at that time. But let's just take 360. You get down to 300, things still look good. Get down to 200, now you're looking at a little ghosting around edges. If you do any sharpening to speak of, it's going to show up. Get down to 100 DPI, you crop the image a little bit, you're in trouble. So the difference between digital capture is that when I have 4,000 pixels along an edge, that's my total number of pixels. When I drum scan an 8x10 or even a 4.5, if I drum scan a 4.5 at 4,000 DPI, I'm going to multiply 5 inches times 4,000, and I'm going to have 20,000 pixels. Now, when I make that 20-inch print with a 20,000 pixel file, I have 1,000 dots per inch. So I have three times as much as I really need. That's a far cry from having half of what I need. And a 16-megapixel camera is expensive. I mean, certainly in the early days, it was more expensive. Ultimately, will they get there? Probably. But there's a huge difference between having 20,000 pixels and having 4,000 pixels.
What do you like about the analog capture versus digital? Like you said, you've had high-end digital. You deal with clients that probably are shooting D3Xs, 1DS Mark IIIs, even P65 plus digital backs. I'm sure you run across the stuff all the time, but I still see you're shooting 8x10. Besides the extra pixels, let's talk about the aesthetics of the analog capture and your thoughts versus the files that you've done and, of course, that you run across with these things every day.
Well, there's two extra factors. The first factor is film real estate. If you can imagine a medium format camera and you're taking a picture of a street scene and there's a telephone pole in the scene, and let's say it's not the biggest part of the scene, and let's say that telephone pole is maybe a quarter of an inch square. If we use 4x5 example, and you have something that's a quarter of an inch square on a piece of 4x5 film, on an 8x10, it's an inch square. So if you just compare how much of the actual tonal and surface quality that you're going to get from a bigger piece of film, you can talk about sharper lenses for smaller cameras and all this kind of stuff all day long. But when it's up against film real estate trumps optical resolution. So that's an added thing. The other added thing is the extended dynamic range, tremendous range of a piece of 8x10 film. Well, either in black and white or in color, it's just they have a tremendous range. In the scanner, unlike in the darkroom where you have to really back off on that range to make sure everything can fit on the range of the paper, the scanner can get it all, especially a drum scanner, can read all the way into the depths. That said, getting away from the technical for a moment, the large format camera actually, by its very nature, makes you slow down. And I think that one can see a more contemplative, and if you slow down too much, your images get sort of staid. I've taught myself to be able to yank the 8x10 out of the trunk of my car, put it up, take a picture in 60 seconds. I don't always do that, but I want to be able to take a quick shot if I want to not have to sort of agonize over every little thing. There are some times when I do. I don't do what I did when I was a student and take an hour to take a shot anymore, but it does lead to a much more considered photograph. Usually when I take a shot, I'll put the camera down a few feet away from where I'm actually going to take the picture. And then I'll walk around. I'll maybe crouch down, get on my toes, look around, understand the angle that I want to take the shot at and what I want to include in the scene. And then I'll usually make a little X on the spot with my shoe and then go back and put the camera there and use the camera as a recording device. And I would suggest anybody starting out that is interested, if street shooting is your game, I don't know that you need to use a large format camera. But if you're interested in the natural world, I would suggest that everybody take a little bit of time trying one of these out, because it's a wonderful way to learn.
I would think 4x5 is small format. Shoot 20-24.
Yeah, if I was contact printing, I'd have to lug one of those around, absolutely. I picked up a little ebony the other day, beautiful titanium movements and whatnot, and wonderful little camera. But what I ultimately ran up against was that the textural quality that I was looking for, I'm looking at an image at the moment that has some afternoon summer sun on a rock, and you can tell. I believe that as far as I've been able to get similar amounts of resolution from the film and the scanner, that particular image is not really possible without an 8x10.
So let's talk about your gear, what you're shooting with before we get back to the scan stuff and the printing is. Tell me, what are you shooting film-wise, how you're developing this stuff?
I'm shooting with a Canon 8x10, lightweight. I shot for most of my life with a Central Universal 8x10, and it finally got a little bit rickety-rackety after 100 years of use by myself and whoever used it before me. So last year, I picked up a brand new Canon. I love Keith Canham's work. It's inspirational to go out and photograph with a camera that beautiful. And I tend to work mostly with a normal lens. I've got a Rodenstock Apo lens, the 12-inch gorgeous piece of glass. And I've got a Nikon, I think it's a 480, that comes out every once in a while. There's sometimes when I'm looking across a scene that I can't walk to. There's a body of water in front of me, and I'm looking at something across the way, and that's when the larger lens comes out. But for the most part, my forays into telephoto haven't yielded the kind of results that I've wanted. I do have a 600, but at this point, I leave it in the car. There's too much haze out there. It's not really what I'm good at. I'm not Ansel Adams. I don't take the grand landscape as much as I do sort of some of the smaller details of things. So that's my favorite shooting thing. You're coming to me after I've just finished a huge run of film testing. For many years, I had trouble with the modern films, and I finally figured them out. We just compared Ilford's Delta and FP4 and HP5 and T-Max 100 and T-Max 400 on a variety of criteria. Everything, including which one's going to be around the longest in our guess, to how much does it cost and whatnot. Right now, I'm shooting with Delta, which I think is a good film. Also, actually included in the test was a film called F-Key, which is from Croatia, which is an excellent film and has a lot of range as far as what you can do to it. You can develop it for a very long time or a very short time, whatever. But it's got a very slow speed. And that's hard. So I'm out here on the West Coast, and we've got a lot of wind. There's a difference for me in shooting 5 seconds and 30 seconds, for example. It's an older film. I think, if I remember correctly, it's from a formula from 1939, so an old Adox formula, and it doesn't have great reciprocity characteristics. You got to really know your reciprocity. So at any rate, we settled on the Delta, and I'm developing it in X-TOLE 1:1, and the results are really fabulous. Also, if I need something a little faster, I'm shooting in the new T-Max 400, TMY2, we call it. And we found that it develops within a few seconds here and there. My N-3 times and N+1 times match that of Delta. So it's kind of handy. I'm using a Jobo to process it in, which I guess one has a tank that develops 5 sheets of 8x10 at a time. It's nice to be able to put all of the film in one thing and not have to worry which holder has what in it, as it were, when one is developing. So I've been very happy with that film. It's good stuff.
So let's get to the rest of the workflow. So you're out shooting, or a client brings you a piece of neg of something, and you currently have this Aztec Premier Pro. So you upgraded from the original drum scanner. Let's talk about why this is cool.
Let's see. The Aztec Premier has what they call a 3-micron engine. And when we talk about microns within the context of a drum scanner, we are basically talking about the sample width. A drum scanner looks a little like and works very much like Edison's first tape recorder. There's a cylinder, and the cylinder is actually moved in front of the light sensor. And with a transparency or with a negative, there's a light source that gets inserted into the drum and shoots out through the drum to the sensor. And why the sensor doesn't move and the whole drum unit moves, I don't know, but it moves over at a 64,000th of an inch at a time. It's capable of incredible resolution. And so having a 3-micron engine, there are basically 8,000 3-micron slices in an inch. It allows for that amount of optical resolution. A lot of scanners out there, and they all talk about resolution, but there's a huge difference between actual number of pixels generated and actual optical resolution. Like, how many bars can you separate on that chart? And there's only two scanners that have ever been made with a 3-micron engine. One is the Aztec Premier, and the other is the ICG 380, which I don't know if they're even making anymore. They're still making Premiers and supporting them and all that sort of stuff. So the optical resolution is just over the top. The other thing is that it allows you to vary the width of this particular sample. And if you are too small, if you imagine a grain, one grain, the software allows you to zoom into the actual grain size and look at it. If you take a slice that's smaller than this grain, what happens is that as the drum rolls around, you're going to end up sampling this twice. And it's probably not going to be in registration when you do so. It's not going to be perfect. And so what's going to happen is you get what's called grain anti-aliasing, and it looks like salt and pepper. And if you match the size of the grain with the width of your sample size exactly, you're going to get perfect resolution down to the grain. If you go too large, it's going to start to blur a little bit. You get a little softness. So what one does when you put a negative on the scanner is you go in there and you look at the grain. You say, okay, what's the width of my sample size? And you set it to absolutely match that. So that's the first thing. And drum scanners start out being sharp because of this. They're sharp as a tack. A drum scanner, for example, knows where it is, has a sensitivity within 1 to 2 microns. A consumer flatbed, probably between 25 and 30 microns. So even though we're talking about very small units, when we're talking about a consumer flatbed, one starts out with a blurry image and sharpens it. I generally have almost no sharpening in my images at all. A radius of 0.2, for example. That's the first thing. The second thing is that all scanners, except for the Aztec, basically allow you to preview an image, throw a curve on it, levels adjustment, whatever you want. And then what the scanner will do, directed by the software, is pull a raw scan and then apply those changes. Now, we all know that applying changes can degrade the image somewhat, depending on how drastic these changes are. The Premier, on the other hand, what its software does, you do the same thing where you preview a scan and you look at different details and whatnot. And then you can actually create a custom film profile for that specific image. So you make your curve adjustments or levels or whatever you want to do, change your colors this way or that, and get it to sort of look pretty close to what you want to print. And that we can talk about later. It's not exactly what you want it to look like, but you want to give yourself every option in the print. And then what it does is it takes that custom film profile and it loads it into the firmware on the scanner. And it tells the scanner, scan in that range. So what comes back is, instead of having a raw scan and then an application of some changes, it has a full histogram, perfect, ready to go with all of those changes intact. So it tells the scanner, scan it this way. And the scanner adjusts all of its settings on the inside. And basically, you have a new scanner for each scan.
Wow, very interesting. So let's touch up on here real quick your printing capabilities at Iger Studios. We'll do some additional program and we'll get into this a little bit more because you have a very, very unique way that you're printing and what you're doing. But give me the glossary overview of what's going on. And we'll dig down into the scanner and printing technologies on another program. But just tell me the rest of the capabilities here of what you're up to.
We have two printers. We've moved away from the Epsons and we now have twin Rolands. They're 54-inch wide FJ540s. And they're both pigment printers and they're both 12 slots. So 12 ink cartridges, as it were. The first one is filled with what's called a DaVinci setup, which is a 12-color, beautiful, extended-range print. It's got not only CMYK and light cyan and light magenta, but orange and green added to the mix, the old hexachrome. Plus, it has four cone blacks that smooth the underlying tonalities. So it's got an extremely accurate color rendition as well as an extended color space. So a couple hundred thousand more colors than a 9800, for example. The other printer I have is set up for dedicated black and white. And I have six warm tones of black and six cold tones of black. And so what I can do is I can print in a warm tone, like a carbon sepia, for those who like that. And I can print a very cold tone on the other side. And for people who like a neutral, I mix all 12 together. And I can split tone and do all kinds of stuff. I start with John Cohn's inks. My favorite is his piezo tone inks. John's done a lot for all of us by inventing this black and white ink technology. But it starts out as a quad black set, so there's four different dilutions of ink, and I expand it to six so that one can actually have way better highlight definition. And so I'm thrilled with the Rolands. They're great printers. They're all metal parts. Changing a damper when you have to is a 15-second procedure instead of some of the others. It cuts where you want it to. It doesn't take an extra 5 inches of paper every time you cut it and whatnot. And we do basically high-end printing for our clients. A lot of times we sit there with our clients and make test print after test print until it's perfect. Everything we do here is museum quality. We like to say that when you want the very best, this is where you come. When we do color matching, we match every single color, color for color. It's exact. And everything is guaranteed. It's the highest quality we know how to do.
I think really your specialty is black and white. And I think we're going to get into this into another program later about why black and white over color. Just looking here and looking at some prints where you have an F print, a platinum, and one of your prints, your stuff looks better than the platinum or the regular F silver. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's been a lot of research. Last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years of really working hard at this, tuning the inks to get them just right. And I use a rip called Studio Print, and it's allowed me to tune every single channel exactly to get a perfect gray ramp. I love black and white. I think as an aesthetic, black and white is still as alive and vibrant as ever. It allows you to talk about things, about interesting concepts, and about big words like integrity and intimacy. A lot of times with color, you're talking about how pretty that color is. My feeling about photography is that it's ultimately the expression in photography is all about what the photographer brings. When you go to photograph something, are you looking at something with disdain? Are you looking at it with honor and respect? A long time ago, I saw a huge retrospective of Lewis Hine's work. He was a photographer that did a lot of work for National Child Labor Committee, photographed immigrants coming into the country at Ellis Island, and also documented the building of the Empire State Building. And in looking at his 240 images that were in that show, I was struck by the feeling that in every single photograph, he allowed the people in the image to shine. And I thought, what a selfless, unselfish human being. And I was very sorry because unfortunately he had died a few years earlier and there was no way that I could actually meet him. But I was immediately drawn to somebody who allowed the other people to be. And so at each point, he wanted to tell their story. Unlike some other photographers, you'll see a heavy graphic design or heavy influence. And I don't want to diss anyone. There's a lot of kinds of photography, all of them valid. But I'm drawn to the ones that have some real insight. And actually, what I saw was Lewis Hine's expression was this allowing what was in the image to really come forward. And that's what I think it's all about. And I think that color sometimes is just overwhelming. And black and white, to me, allows you to really understand things and really see the influence of the photographer and see where it comes from. I mean, there's an image I'm looking at, and there's a woman that I took a photograph of, and this is back a lot of years, and we were good friends. She was my best friend's girlfriend, in fact, and we were dear friends, and she sat still for 90 seconds. And with a 90-second exposure of a human, of a rock is one thing, but of a person, you can't just go, okay, I'm going to open the shutter now. I'm going to get some coffee. I'll be right back. You sit still. Doesn't work. You have to sort of stop, get really slow yourself, and breathe with them and look straight at them. And what happens is that your relationship reveals itself. And so ours was one of real intimacy. She wasn't my best friend's girlfriend. She probably would have been my girlfriend had I been able to find her. There was a certain amount of friendly intimacy between us, and it comes across. So I like the idea of being able to talk about a word like intimacy rather than a word like, oh, isn't that a nice color of orange? So, yeah, or a set of words, as it were.
I guess they both have their place, but like you said, you can really convey a lot with black and white a lot of times more than color.
It's true. And I think that I'm a real student of history. As part of getting an education, I got to study art history for 6 years and history of photography for another 2 or 3 years. I had a lot of great opportunities. I think there's a lot of people out there trying to get the shot, and it's almost like collecting images. For me, it's really not about the shot. It's about life. Ultimately, it's about what wisdom do you have to share with the rest of us? And I think there's been a lot of great photography that's gone before that has shared a lot of wisdom with the rest of us. From the beginning, absolutely. There's a lot of things that have been talked about, whether you want to look at Lewis Hine or Robert Frank or Frederick Evans, who taught us about light, or Walker Evans, who taught us about looking at things from a very straight perspective and not influencing it too much. And the history of black and white is really, in my mind, the history of most of this. So there's plenty of room for everybody else. There's lots of nature photographers and wildlife photographers and everything else. But I'm interested, as I said in the beginning, in the stuff that actually teaches me things.
So how do we find out more information about your photography, your work, Iger Studios, these exceptional drum scans, people that might want to look to have some of these editions done that you're printing? How do they get a hold and see what you're up to?
Well, we're here about an hour north of San Francisco. Our doors are usually open. We have a website at igerstudios.com. So that's E-I-G-E-R studios, plural.com. We're at 707-763-5922. If you're local, come over and visit. There's a lot of people that have said a lot of things about what inkjet prints are capable and not capable of. And I'd invite any and all of them to come on over and see. We have a little mini gallery here at the studio with a lot of my work and the other work that's being worked on. Come on over and see what's possible.
I know a few of my buddies have seen some of your work and are highly impressed. And these people that have said these comments are very hard to impress. You really need to see it. It's hard to explain. You can look at the stuff on the website, but you need to see it in person.
Yeah, it's very hard to express a real tonal range on a little 3-inch wide web JPEG, as it were. There's a reason why there still is photographic prints.
Well, the thing is, if you don't have a print, you don't have a photograph. There's an image on a screen, there's a negative, but it's not a photograph until it's a print.
I would say so. I have the camera work reviewer that I have on the wall is a Clarence White from 1910. It's an image called Morning, and it feeds me. I remember when I first saw it, it was in sort of the influences section. Clarence White was one of the great teachers of photography back in 1925 to 35 range in New York City. I mean, there aren't a lot of images of his in history, but there's just a handful. And this one, when I first saw it, my jaw dropped. And I don't know, I think I must have stopped breathing for a minute or two. I mean, I was just stunned. And I know a lot of people have had this experience when looking at a photograph at some point in their lives. I was transfixed. The interesting part about it is that when I left New York in 1984, I had just enough money to get out here. And it was either leave New York, go on my trip out to the West Coast, or buy this photograph. And I had had a rough time in New York. I mean, I had a great time getting an education there. It was a wonderful education. But I just had to go. And I had been secretly in the back of my mind wanting this image for 22 years. And a couple of years ago, I saw it at a show. I pulled out my checkbook and wrote a check. It was as simple as that. Every time I look at it, I get something new out of it. And sure, it's a photo secessionist image. It's a soft focused image, but there's something about the atmosphere. I learned to print from these old pictures. As much as my schooling was a great education, and I have nothing but great things to say about it, the other way that I learned to print was by going to Christie's and Sotheby's the day before an auction. And I would get to hold up these prints in my hands and look at them from 6 inches away that were 100 or 150 years old. And I saw Julia Margaret Cameron and Frederick Evans, Sutcliffe, and all these things. And I'm looking at these old prints and some new ones as well. But I'm looking at these old prints that are albumin. How'd they get that much atmosphere out of albumin, for crying out loud? So I studied. I studied printing. Printing has always been a passion of mine. I studied it. Being in New York was a great education, and it's great when we have great artwork to look at.
We're definitely going to be chatting more about hybrid workflows. I think that in the current state of what's going on, if people don't embrace hybrid workflow with analog photography, it's just going to accelerate the death of film faster.
I would say you're probably right about that. I think that as much as some people like silver printing film, films are dying left and right. The ones that aren't being used by everybody are dying left and right. While I started my own hybrid workflow because I didn't want to build yet another wet darkroom, today I have the resources to build a wet darkroom, and I don't choose to. The reason I'm doing this is because I'm actually getting the quality that I want. The quality of John Cohn's ink, for example, is exceptional. The archival quality is exceptional. The longevity of it, it's primarily pure carbon in an ink base. He's now in his third generation, and he's gotten it to work very well. And so it's the same thing. And whether you're working in a silver darkroom or a hybrid workflow, you have to know what's possible. Just because you're working in one form or another doesn't mean the prints are going to be great. They're going to be great if you're a great printer. If you study enough about printing and you look at the kind of prints you want to make that other people have made, and you identify what the qualities are and say, you know, I'd like to make a print like that, and then go after it enough times, then you learn your skills. You get your chops, as they say in music. And so I would say in the right hands, this is an incredible, incredible medium. I think it's only going to grow. I mean, I love the hybrid workflow. It's fabulous. I mean, the ability of Photoshop, as much as I sometimes have a love-hate relationship with it and get frustrated, I'm dealing with large files oftentimes, and Photoshop isn't there yet in some ways. I think they're trying to satisfy too many different groups of people in one program. But its abilities to separate a particular area and burn and dodge seamlessly, but it's to allow you to sort of bring tonalities up and areas of tonality up and separate things in ways, it's actually superior in my mind. And if one likes the darkroom surface of a silver paper, then by all means, use that.
You can replicate this, though. I mean, you can print with your process on an F-surface type paper, and it looks as good or better. I mean, I guess there's the argument of, okay, well, there's no silver in it, so I'm not getting this reflectivity depending on how it's being shown. But you can make it looks like F-surface paper. You can do whatever you want. I think that's what's cool about it is the adjustability, what you can do with it. You can print on pretty much anything now with an inkjet-based machine. You can print on material. You can print on any funky paper. If you can run it through the machine, you can spray ink on it, and you can get some pretty neat stuff out of it. And even more so, I mean, you have these big, huge monster, wide format, DaVinci type stuff, and with what you're doing, mixing your own ink. But people can buy a desktop printer and get amazing results. So I think to keep film alive and be able to enjoy classic cameras and the look and the feel that you get out of film, very, very hard to replicate in digital. You can still do analog photography, do great work, have fun with it, but then you can print it out. You can go buy a printer for $89. And it's going to come with some version of some software, and probably for free. And you can take your photo you shot, and they could scan it at Costco, and guess what? You can still make a cool print. So film's still being utilized. You're still keeping analog alive, and then you can go all the way up to the stuff like you're doing. So I think this analog hybrid deal is very cool. A lot of people can't buy an enlarger and set it up in their bathroom. They don't have the know-how. They can't figure it out.
E6 labs are hard to find. They're all going out of business, unfortunately. So I think that the hybrid workflow, in my opinion, is really the best. I mean, certainly contact prints of every sort. I've got a buddy on the East Coast, Sandy King, who makes carbon tissue prints. They're exquisite. There's a lot of people working in a lot of different mediums, and that's all great. I think you're right. I think that more than likely, we're going to have less and less paper.
Well, isn't Sandy doing hybrid stuff?
Yeah.
They're taking stuff, they're scanning it, they're making digital negatives. And they're doing these alternate process contact prints. I think you could print out a 40 by 60 contact neg and do monster platinum.
Absolutely. If one could afford the platinum, I would. Actually, I'm the first guy that did that back in 1980. Not to make a 60-inch platinum, but I wanted to make 16 by 20 platinums. And I found some guy who had an old Hell 299 scanner in 1980. The thing was as big as a car. I mean, it was a huge thing. And it had what they call a contone head or a continuous tone head. that they could put on instead of the halftone dot. It was basically a color separation machine for doing stuff for magazines. And this guy would tell me, well, yeah, just tell me what you want and top and bottom end densities, and I'll just do it for you. And I said, okay. And I gave him my 8x10s, and I made 16 by 20 negatives. And when Dick Sullivan of Bostick and Sullivan first saw them, he said, oh, it can't be a platinum. They're too big. The images are too big. He called me the very next day, and I said, no, actually, that's platinum. But that was a long time ago, and we've come a long way since then. But yeah, I think a large majority of the platinum printers today are making their negs on some form of Epson printer or something like that, using the, what is that, clear Pictorico, I think. I mean, I think film and scan is a great way to go. It's got all the sharpness and resolution that you want. It's got all the tonality that you want. And whatever you do with it afterwards is up to you. So whether you want to make an alternative print or whether you want to make an inkjet print like we do on Hanamule Photo Rag, whether you want a warm tone, a cold tone, high contrast print or a low contrast print, you have all of that range. And I'm guessing this is the way it's going to go for a while.
And of course, you got a negative, so you can still shine light through it and make a traditional print. 20 years from now, 5 years from now, 2 weeks from now, as long as you capture analog on film, well, there you go.
Yeah. I think that it's likely digital capture will get there. And if I could carry around a medium format camera and get the same quality that I'm getting off an 8x10, I'd certainly want to carry a smaller camera.
Well, you could if you bought a P65 back, but do you want to go spend $45,000 on a back and then buy another kit with another body and a bunch of glass? And you're equal to maybe 4x5.
My brand new camera cost me $3,000 up against, what's that new kit cost, really?
$100,000.
Yeah, it's $100,000, and then you got to lug around a little laptop or something to plug it into. It's got to be tethered somehow. So,
not there yet.
Well, in color, I think they're pretty close. Black and white, they cannot make the prints that I have on the wall. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, there's a lot of people who say, oh, this, oh, that, oh, the resolution of the glass is such and such, this and this and this and this and that. Some guy tried to tell me I only had 72 megapixels worth of information on my scans. There are so many other variables in it that the statement is patently ridiculous. I mean, sure, my scan of an 8x10 is 568 megapixels. So I look at it, well, you want 50 or you want 568? Which one do you want? But it's true that there's only so much resolution in the glass, even with my fancy Rodenstock glass. But it's also true that there's all these other things like dynamic range, film real estate, which you cannot argue with film real estate. You just can't.
Bigger sensor, better. Bigger film, better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I was shooting, I would go with a medium format sensor or maybe something even larger. I think they ought to make a 4x5 sensor.
Or a scan back. There you go.
Yeah, a scan back.
But it goes to the deal. Do you want to wait 5 minutes or even more? I guess for the scan backs now, you can get some pretty decent quality in less than a minute. But still, it's difficult. It's tethered. Some stunning images out of it. But still, I like film.
I like film. Film is inexpensive, it's handy, and the digital capture is extremely expensive. I still don't think it's there, even the most expensive setup that you can get. It might be just fine for shooting in the studio where you have controlled lighting and you can do 16 pops or whatever you need to do. There is all sorts of things.
You know what it's good for?
What's that?
Shooting test samples, so when you want to shoot some 8x10, you use the digital to test it and then shoot it on Chrome.
There you go. There you go. Love it.
Lenny, thanks so much. I really appreciate you chatting with us today. We're going to be talking more about scanning, aesthetics of black and white, large format photography, and a lot of stuff. But just to give us an overview today of your beautiful photography, your work, and Iger Studios. Very cool.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, there you go. Lenny Iger. Great stuff going on with Lenny. You got to check out his work. Check out his website. He's got beautiful photography. He's doing great work with the scanning, his printmaking that he's doing. Definitely check out IgerStudios.com. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo, and of course, been brought to you by our photographic philanthropy partners of George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.eastmanhouse.org, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog photography at apug.org, Fujifilm USA, with the brand new Instaxes in the country. This is great instant photography, and of course, all emulsions, C41, Chrome, black and white, you name it, check them out. FujifilmUSA.com/professional. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at RichardPhotoLab.com. DR5 for the rock and black and white chrome at DR5.com. Our friends over at, of course, Iger Studios at IgerStudios.com. And Upstrap, upstrap-pro.com. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.